Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Seattle Nights, the only podcast that tells you what's really happening in Seattle politics. I'm David Hyde, and on today's show, a live city attorney candidate forum at the Parkview Event Space in South Lake Union with an amazing live audience. They're just not that into baseball. They're here tonight. We're going to bring in our two candidates in just a minute. But first, Erica C. Barnett of Publicola. This is being built as a forum and not a debate. That may be why they asked us as Seattle Nice to do it, because it's a very Seattle Nice use of language. Not a debate. It's a forum.
I think this may be our first rated G podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Hopefully, what warning in advance.
No one told me that.
Also with us, political consultant and Mets fan. You can boo there. Yeah. Sandeep Kashyap.
Yeah. Hi, David. Hi, Erica.
All right. And let's get to our city attorney candidates, starting with the first woman elected Seattle city attorney, incumbent Ann Davison. Prior to this job, Ann Davison practiced law in areas including civil litigation, immigration, sports, contracts, and business transactions. Thank you so much for participating.
Thank you.
And challenger Erica Evans, whose legal career started in the Seattle City Attorney's Office. And Erica Evans recently served as an assistant U.S. attorney for the Department of Justice. Let's hear it for Erica Evans.
First question is for City Attorney Davison. You implemented a high utilizers policy that focuses on people who cycle through the criminal justice system, saying it would reduce crime by targeting the people who are causing most of the problems. Do you believe this program has worked to reduce thefts and drug misdemeanors, and in what way?
I absolutely do. I started that in March of 2022, a few months after I took office. I brought an unprecedented amount of data transparency to the public so you can understand the functions of the city attorney's office and I can make the best decisions on behalf of the public. And what we found out was 118 individuals were responsible for 2,400 police referrals. And a referral is a police report. I can't measure in crimes. So that's more than those crimes, 2,400 being more thousands of crimes. And what we've done by staying current on the data, by partnering with the King County Prosecutor and Attorney's Office, partnering with police, partnering with programs that are looking to help community members that are there, we are understanding what's happening for those individuals where neighborhoods were really inundated by criminal activity. And by use of data, we can forecast that we've reduced referrals by over 3,000 referrals over the course of this initiative. So that's thousands of crimes that we have prevented because we have focused on people who had the most significant amount of criminal activity. When we started it, people had about 20, 30, 40 referrals. We had a set of criteria, people to meet that. And now we have people that are just barely meeting the criteria and just right over that. So we really are not seeing people that we started the initiative with, people who had sometimes 40 referrals for theft, sometimes one location multiple times a day. We had retailers who had their employees harassed, threatened on a multiple day incidents by individuals. So we really building the responsiveness for that.
All right. This question is for Erica. When we spoke earlier this year, you said that you thought the high utilizer initiative overemphasizes incarceration. Would you keep this initiative? And if so, what would you change about it? If not, how would you address the problem of people who commit misdemeanors over and over, like shoplifting?
Thank you so much for the question. Yeah. I think we do absolutely need to keep this list. And we need to keep this list to be providing the right services for these folks. What we saw in the data with this high initiatives list is that people are on this list are folks that are not competent to stand trial, folks that are dealing with substance use disorder, folks that are unhoused. And so, yes, when we're just criminalizing and not allowing these folks to get the right services to address the root causes, they're going to keep being, you know, repeat offenders. And so being smart on our public dollars and how we're effectively using resources to stop repeat offenses, to stop what we're seeing in our streets, you have to be smart and evidence-based. And what I'm going to do as the next city attorney is making sure we have this list to be providing the right services and treatment to these folks so they're not getting out and reoffending. Thank you for the question.
Great. I'll ask the next question. So, Erica, we'll start with you on this one. Public safety is a fraud issue, right, in the city. And there have been certainly like deep debates and deep divides over it. And clearly in this race, we've seen the kind of differences between yourself and City Attorney Davison about approaches to public safety. So coming at it from a little bit of a different angle. But my question to you, Erica, is there something that a significant issue or policy that the city attorney has enacted or done during her tenure that you really strongly agree with and would like to continue?
Yes. I think that the Glock initiative that current City Attorney Davison started was good. It could have been started sooner, but it's nonetheless, it was a great thing to bring forward. You know, you also asked about public safety in general, Sandeep, and one of the recent things that came out in the Seattle Times from a report from the Department of Public Defense is how folks that are dealing with addiction, folks that are, you know, using in public, how 215 people have been prosecuted by the current city attorney's office, and 97% of those folks don't get treatment. And that's unacceptable, and that's not public safety, because if someone's not going to get treatment, they're going to be right back on the streets, right back out in front of businesses without addressing underlying services. And with the law change, with the Blake fix, it was the purpose of the law to provide treatments with experts like LEAD. And that's it was really unfortunate to read those findings that 97% of those folks under the current leadership are not getting the treatment that they need.
What my opponent calls the Glock initiative is actually a lawsuit. And so I sued the firearms maker, a Glock, the other firearms maker, because I believe that what their design of their firearm is a contribute to public nuisance work. We've heard that incidents where there's multiple shots fired, 40 shots fired, 50 shots fired. We had one that recently was 90 shots fired. Is because the design of that firearm is very susceptible, very easily switched from a semi-automatic to a fully automatic. And I'd like that to come to the table and help to reduce the gunshot that we have.
So the flip side of the question for you, City Attorney Davison, is there a progressive public policy position advocated by your opponent that you would adopt if you're reelected?
I have doubled the diversion programs, and I believe that those were things I would continue and look to enhance. Not for sure to keep up with that. When I closed community court, I chose to double my diversion programs because we could really control better about the program that was offered. What was only being offered in community court was just to watch a life skills video. To me, that's not really going to help us reduce recidivism, and it was showing, in fact, it did not. So I've doubled the diversion programs. I increased age eligibility for when we offer conversion. And so I'm showing the data about that so we can all make well-informed decisions about is that a good use of the tax dollars for diversion programs. And I'm showing that, yes, that actually with someone's early in criminal activity, if we put them into the right type of a program, we are not seeing them again. Compared to, again, the other end of the continuum is the high utilizer initiative, where we had people with multiple referrals in a short amount of time. And that's not where we want to look for.
Hey, Seattle Nice listeners. Seattle politics got you low? Well, get high with Uncle Ike's. Pissed at the mayor? Relax with a dollar joint. Pop a tire in a pothole? Eat a $2 gummy and chill. Whether you need something to pump you up for Saturday's protest or a mellow strain for your next sit-in, Ike's is your best friend. Now is the time to roll up, Seattle. Download the Ike's app today or head on over to Ike's.com. That's Ike's.com.
And may I respond really quickly? Thank you
sure.
So much.
30 seconds.
Yes, there was a drug alternative. It was kind of like a community court that was brought back under the current leadership. And when we actually look at what that does, it doesn't have any requirements that someone gets treatment. And what's also unfortunate is that the folks that are getting charged with drug possession or drug use, they are ineligible for pre-file diversion. Those people, that 215 study that I mentioned that was came out with from the Department of Public Defense, those folks could be going to LEAD. And
So I think we're going to get into that question a little bit later. So you both have more opportunity to talk about it. But let's move on to the next question.
Okay, for City Attorney Ann Davison, crime is down a little bit here in Seattle. It's down nationally. That's good news. But I was looking at this 2025 FBI study looking at 2024. Seattle ranks fourth out of the 30 largest U.S. cities for total crime, third worst for property crime, some of which would fall under your office. And so I'm wondering what you've done to address low-level misdemeanors like shoplifting or vandalism, people breaking windows, for example, and why property crime is so persistent.
Well, I really appreciate the question because people want to keep describing misdemeanors as low level, but it's 80% of the crimes. So sadly, if you become a victim of crime, it's most likely it will be from a misdemeanor. I want to bring innovation. I'm coming to bring change. My predecessor, my mom, that controlled the office for 12 years. So I want to make sure that we are being creative, innovative. What can we do to improve public safety beyond just hiring more police officers? That's why I proposed, the council has enacted, a civil liability where I can civilly sue adult prolific graffiti tatters. I started 3 lawsuits. They get fined for that. They can pay and contribute to the cleanup, or they can come spend their time to clean it up themselves, or the cheapest way was to not commit the crime in the first place. I have doubled retail theft prosecution in my administration. Again, could we want to foster economic vitality? We need anchor tenants. We need small business, but we need large anchor tenants to create that neighborhood of fostering of a small business environment. That's why I focused on through the Highway West Initiative as well, a doubling retail theft prosecution. Because of that, because when it comes to property damage, is where really, even though it isn't a harm to a person necessarily, it is the threat of feeling that the laws don't matter. And we should not be going back to that time period where it felt like the laws didn't matter and you had to take on that responsibility yourself.
Erica Evans, same question, shoplifting and vandalism. How are you different? Would you seek jail time in certain instances for prolific offenders when it comes to things like shoplifting or vandalism cases? If not, why not? If yes, what criteria would you use? But really just how are you two different?
Yeah, I think accountability is important. As someone that's worked in public safety my whole career as a lawyer, you know, from the city level being a city prosecutor to working at the United States as a federal prosecutor, accountability is important. And when we are looking at cases, I know my opponent mentioned, you know, the graffiti and really championing that. I think there's a few things on balance that I think of and what I've heard in community. Yes, if someone's, you know, vandalizing or, you know, doing something on property that's not theirs, just like our parents taught us, we should clean it up. But making new, legislation to champion and civilly sue and spend all that resources. It costs a lot of money to have lawyers go in and civilly sue someone. That is a ton of resources being thrown at it. And the penalty is something that's even higher than someone committing animal abuse. And so to champion, you know, that when there's problems we're hearing in community, things we're seeing right now in our streets, people suffering, we're not providing the right response to actually address the evidence we're seeing on our streets.
Can I just add a correction? I have a civil enforcement unit, so this is a line attorney in my civil division that takes on those cases for the adult prolific graffiti tatters.
Here's one from the audience for both of you. This came in before we started this debate. First question is for you, City Attorney Davison. The City Attorney's Office has now had several years under your leadership. Many residents say they still see repeat offenders cycling through the system with little consequence. What measurable progress can you point to that shows that your approach is working?
Well, I will again go back to the high leadership where we can forecast that we are not seeing those individuals again. And again, I tell you about the first cohort that met the criteria. They had, most of them had over 20 referrals. And again, because prior, and my predecessor, who my opponent worked for, that was the iteration of the community court, where people were automatically routed to community court regardless of criminal history. So somebody can have 40 referrals for theft, pending felonies, but the automatic response was they were going to community court. That is not the way the begin is still accountability. This is not where you're going to make improvements in public safety. So when we're looking at what can we do, it's important to understand that we do look at competency. We do not put people on the high-utilization list who were incompetent. There is some overlay where we're having to work the community because at the misdemeanor level, when somebody is incompetent, there is not things that we can do as a state legislature, deprioritization of restoration in the area of competency. So even our firefighters have had to ask me about the complicated system of why they see people that are back out. And some that is set because it's larger than my office can control, but I'm absolutely committed to making sure we make that better. Because the longer we leave somebody exposed to drugs, they will start to lose competency, particularly meth, and over long-term time, they will not be able to regain competency. And that is absolutely not good for that individual. Neither is it good for us as a whole because we're having to pay for the long-term care.
Similar question for you, Erica. What would you do differently in your first 6 months to break the cycle of repeat offenses without simply filling up the jails again?
Yeah, I'm thinking of the data that we have that 97% of folks under the current leadership don't get treatment. And those are people that without treatment are going to be right back out in the same scenario. And so making sure those folks are actually getting evidence-based treatment and services with providers like LEAD. I'm also thinking about prioritizing domestic violence in DUI cases, something that, for example, domestic violence cases on average last year took 56 days to file. The prior leadership, it took half that time on average for 2028. And those are cases that really people's lives are at risk when someone gets arrested and they get out without a protection order or without a firearm surrendering. Those are cases that need to be really prioritized and moved on quickly. That's something we're going to be prioritizing and doing differently. The same with DUIs. Another thing I would mention is making sure we're not dismissing so many cases. On average last year, with the data, 60% of all cases set for jury trial were dismissed. And to be clear, as a prosecutor, your role sometimes is to dismiss cases if it's an improper case or if there's issues with it. But 60% means that way too many cases are just being filed to get numbers up, and then you're ultimately dumping it. That is wasting taxpayer dollars because we are paying for that when folks have to go to court for pretrial hearings, for a judge to be their bailiff. And I will stop talking.
I'd like to question you that there's questions that are on those topics, the DV and the UI.
You could do a follow-up if you want.
Okay. Yeah. I'd like to make sure that people understand. But the prior administration, again, what my opponent worked for, is from 2017 to 2021, the average was around the firearm filing was 200 days. Of my average in 2022 is 60 days. I am the first woman in this role. I have also the first cemented violence investigator in this office. I sought a grant to get an investigator. So I absolutely prioritize domestic violence. DUI is a very significant topic. The state house culture backlog is 571 days. That is the only lab by state law that can do the blood test for impaired driving. It is 571 days.
We're at time.
What was the legislation for that? And would like to continue at the next session to get that passed.
Can I respond really quickly? I think current City Attorney Davidson's credit, there is a backlog with the lab. I know I've done these cases before. There is another way to go forward, and it's by the affected by prong. It's a process, and you're shaking your head. There are cases I've actually done and been successful on. And I think another thing when we talk about getting things done in the legislature, it comes with collaboration and having partners and leaders behind you. We have more elected officials than anyone in this race, and I'm really proud of the coalition that we've built. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's move on. I have a question related to addiction. It's a topic we've talked about a lot on Seattle Nice because it's, I think, a very live issue in the city of Seattle because the impacts of addiction on our streets and on our quality of life. And so I think there's broad agreement in Seattle that our first response to addiction is not or should not be to put people in jail. But to my mind, that's sort of where the agreement ends. And so let me start with City Attorney Davidson. You supported the Seattle law passed by the council in 2023 that restored a criminal sanction for the public use of hard drugs. And so why is that? Why should we not see that as a return to the failed policies of the war on drugs era?
I very deeply appreciate this question, Cindy, because it really is, my children are young teenagers, and what you've, if you've lived in Seattle since 2021 before then, you know what they only know for like that. And it is seeing people that are subsisting alongside our roadways who are in the throes of addiction, and their family members have been left without respite. So it should not be that the first thing is in custody time, but it is a complicated thing. And when somebody is unable to get into a monitored treatment, our state laws are very conservative to force somebody into treatment. We are trying to help get people into treatment. That is the underlying drug use and possession law. It was a felony for the first time in state history. It's now at the city level. That's why we've had to build out what we've built. But the point of that underlying drug use and possession law is to get people into treatment. That is what we're trying to do. All of this discussion over here about B, that is happening. That is directed by police. I don't direct the police. That is the mayor. So if law enforcement is going to put those into B, that is their decision. I also have a coordination with that program. But then if people don't engage in treatment, it then might come to my office. And then at some point, we have to be the social guardrails. When someone is unable to choose treatment for themselves, we have to be also focusing on the public as a whole and making sure our public spaces are safe for everyone to access.
Thank you. The flip side of this question, Erica Evans, for you. You oppose the Seattle drug law that was passed in 2023. So why shouldn't voters see that as a carte blanche enabling of addiction? In other words, not just destigmatizing addiction, but in some sense, normalizing it if we don't have a law.
I want to be clear. You know, I believe there's nothing wrong with retaining the right to charge someone if progress is not being made. What needs to be done, what was said with this law, the purpose was for treatment. I support that. That's what the law says. I support that. What we're seeing with the 215 cases since this law was passed is that 97% of them are not getting treatment. You know, I'm honored to have Lisa Dugard's sole endorsement, the founder of LEAD. These cases could be going to LEAD, and they're not. That is failure. It's failure when we also look at the data that Black people are 4.1 more times represented in that group. That's failure. And that is not applying the rule of law equitably or fairly.
Again, I will say the law enforcement assisted diversion is called law enforcement assisted diversion. I don't direct the police. So any disproportionality is not in my office. And I don't control whether or not somebody participates in treatment that is offered to that program.
Thank you.
Okay. This is sort of the elephant in the room question, Ann Davison, because you're a Republican. Most people in Seattle are not. There's a story in the Seattle Times today saying it's an issue in the race. And some of your supporters have urged you to leave the Republican Party, including Congressman Adam Smith, a Democrat, told us that on Seattle Nice, I think. But you haven't taken that advice. And so the question is, what is it about the Republican Party? What are the values or policies that make you say, no, I really need to stick with the GOP, even if it might cost me my job in a very blue city?
It's important to understand, I lived here for 30 years, and I was somebody who just was like you, sitting out there. And when the bad policies of Pete Holmes and my opponent, who she wants to bring them back, started to monopolize the conversation between me and my children, I started to educate myself about who are the people making these decisions. When I had to understand how to unpack bad policies, extreme policies, and child-appropriate language, that's when I decided I have to take action. Instead of quitting the city in 2021, like my opponent said, I chose to stand up and run for this office, centering victims and talking about how we can prioritize public safety. I want to make sure we're bringing the policies that are responsive to the social problems of our city. And it is a nonpartisan office. And it really is about problem solving for the city's problems. And that's what I've always been about. And I will take drastic moves if needed. I'm here to make change because we should not go back to the 12 years we had before. We need to, again, making sure the rule of law matters, the law applied equally to all of us. And we need to make sure that that's where our children are growing up and understanding as well.
And may I respond quickly?
I have a question.
I was brought up a few times in that, so I think it's only
you can,
fair.
But I have a question for you, so maybe we could do that plus a follow-up. See,
okay,
see where it goes.
We'll see.
Go ahead, 30 seconds.
Thank you so much. The question wasn't answered. You know, it's someone deciding to join the Trump Party 3.5 years after experiencing Trump the first time, I think really speaks to someone's judgment and where their values are. And those don't align with the values here in Seattle. What's important also, you know, my opponent said I left the city. Yes, I left the city to serve the United States as an assistant United States attorney, which is a very prestigious job that only a handful of folks get the privilege and honor to serve.
So the issue here, it seems like, or one of the issues that you've raised beyond sort of values has to do with the idea that you would fight against the Trump administration with more urgency, is the quote in the Seattle Times today. So my question is really about priorities. You've only got so many city attorneys working for you. Do you have the capacity to bring more lawsuits, more new lawsuits, research new lawsuits against the Trump administration beyond what the city attorney is currently doing? And at the same time, move to more quickly do the work of the city attorney that you would also, you know, want some of these cases resolved more quickly. So can you do all of that?
Absolutely. And it comes with experience actually doing this work in public safety. You know, having the partners like our Attorney General, Nick Brown, who's leading the charge, has solely endorsed this campaign because they trust me and my experience. I think you asked about things that could also be done. It comes with partnering with other cities and counties that are doing proactive work to fight back against the Trump administration. We can look to a case, King County v. Turner, something that had to do with congressionally approved funding for housing and transportation that Trump was saying, you're not going to get it if you have abortion and gender ideology and diversity in your programming. That is something the city of Seattle could have joined. King County joined. The city of San Francisco joined. Bellevue joined. We should have been joining that. There are things that you can do together when you work in partnership with others. It's not just about one person, but it's about the team around you. And I see the city attorney's office being a place where people are excited to work at, where we bring excellence, people from places like the Department of Justice that have that prestige and expertise to get the job done and to do it effectively and be good stewards of our public dollar and a public safety.
I've had to always sue the Trump administration not once, not twice, but 3 times so far. And the case that's decided by my opponent has a certain type of structure where it's very focused on the grants. So we're having to add and add and add. I took a different strategy and I focused on the executive orders because I think it's a better strategy. Again, focusing on when and the timing and making sure you're the first doesn't mean you're the smartest. It is making sure we're protecting the city of Seattle from federal overreach at every absolute step. I have a federal response team that is already in place. We are already monitoring on the daily everything.
So community court came up earlier, and we're going to get back to it in this question. City Attorney Davison, you ended community court in 2023 and replaced it with a new drug prosecution alternative where people can have their charges dropped if they go through a substance abuse assessment and don't get arrested for 60 days. The recent report, which your opponent has brought up several times from the King County Department of Public Defense, found that just 6 people who opted into this new alternative got referrals to treatment. And that's just referrals. It doesn't mean they complete it. Are you satisfied with this result? And if you're reelected, what will you do to increase that number?
Eric, if I may, I'd like to clear up something, though, which either misunderstood or misrepresented. The closure of community court was not replaced with a drug prosecution alternative. They are 2 separate different things. Again, the community court, as I said earlier, was something my predecessor agreed to. My opponent was a part of that. This was where people were automatically routed into community court, where they did not look at criminal history. They did not look at pending charges. They did not look at how many times SIPDA had been referred to city attorney's office, automatically routed for theft, harassment, for frightened crimes to go to community court. And the thing that was happening was watching a video for life skills. That was the only consequence. It increased recidivism. It actually encouraged people to commit crime. So I pulled out from that and again, doubled diversion programs for less cost and better results. Separately, when the state legislature defelonized drug use and possession, And if for the first time in our state's history, came down to the city level as a gross misdemeanor, we had to build something out. And we have a different system. We don't have felony level as I would prosecute misdemeanor, gross misdemeanor for adults in the city of Seattle. And so we had to build something else. So we started to build that, and I had to wait for the appropriators, our city council, and our mayor, who supported this. And it is a place where it's an alternative. That's why there's not people in treatment, because it's not court ordered. This is a diversion. That's why there's not people in this whole report, 97 people, whatever the number is, keep saying. It is not mandated because it's not a condition.
And may I respond really quickly?
Sure.
With the drug alternative, which is, in a sense, kind of like a community or a treatment court, what's set up and required and what is currently in place is a little bit ridiculous. Folks go through this program. They have to agree to a SOTA order, and it's only 60 days, and they just have to get an assessment.
And SOTA, just for the sake of the audience, stay out of drug area.
Yes,
order.
That's right. And that's it, just an assessment. So someone that's smoking fentanyl, they have to go get an assessment by an assessor that we as taxpayers are paying for to tell them whether they have a fentanyl addiction or not. No treatment. It's correct. Wasting resources, and it's cycling folks in and out, and it's not addressing what we're seeing on our streets.
Erica, you've said that your opponent's decision to end community court was a disaster, but critics and your opponents say that community court let people out of prosecution without requiring them to do anything, including restitution or participating in meaningful services or treatment. How do you respond to those criticisms? And would you restore community court in its previous form if you're elected?
Not in its previous form. I'm seeing a reimagined community court. There needs to be accountability. And there needs to be the right services and the right response. I've gone across our state and looked at models that are working, places like Tacoma, Auburn, Redmond, Bellevue just opened one. And what they're doing is they're putting their community court in community places like a library. And they have all the service and treatment providers come in and provide the right response. So folks that want to get into treatment, they can. Folks that have pets that need to go into treatment, but they don't want to lose their pets are going to have that available. So it's providing the right low barrier response to meet the need of folks. And it works, and it reduces the recidivism. So folks are rehabilitated and not getting out and reoffending. That is a reimagined community court that I envision and will bring as the next city attorney.
Again, there's a court resource center where all of these things are available. It's on this report that is appropriate by city council and our mayor to a budgetary thing. There's no authority, finance authority by the city attorney to develop those things that she's describing. And so that is a nice word to hear, community court. And I understand the reason why we want to say that, but we have things that are essentially.
And I'll really be quick. It comes again back to partnerships. You know, we are endorsed by a majority of the current city council. It comes with, you know, thinking of the Department of Public Defense. Folks want more treatment and services type methods. And so having good partnerships is important to get it
understood.
Done.
Thank you. So
that's incorrect. It's not. It's the majority. We have the same number of councils. That's incorrect.
Thank you. Okay, let's move on. Erica, we'll start with you, but it's the same question for both of you. And my last question was about addiction, but I also want to ask about untreated mental illness on the streets of Seattle. All of us see it and have encountered folks that are in crisis or really suffering on our streets and seemingly without any kind of intervention. So I guess I want to ask a question about our involuntary commitment system here and whether you think it is working effectively to address serious untreated mental illness. And is there anything you would like to change about how we currently handle those sorts of situations if you're elected?
Yeah, thank you for that. You know, in this campaign, I've walked with community groups like We Deliver Care, and we've walked to Little Saigon multiple times, and there is a need right now. There is a need for services, for mobile medical, for folks to have connections to treatment and service providers and housing. So what I see is having more options available for that. I think that not enough is being done. And it's really sad. You know, we should be seeing folks that are being left untreated, being forgotten about as, you know, failures from leadership. there is opportunities for us to be good partners in helping what we're seeing on the streets. And that's the type of partner and city attorney that I will be.
And City Attorney Davison, do you think our involuntary commitment system is working, is being utilized correctly? And more broadly than that, how, you know, our general approach to how we're handling cases of untreated mental illness on our streets, are we getting that right? And if not, what would you change?
We absolutely are not currently getting that right. And that is really the significant piece that I'd like your listeners to understand. Again, our state legislature in 2019 deprioritized getting people at the misdemeanor level the store. That means going to Western or Eastern State Hospital and getting them stable so they can participate in their defense. If they can participate in their defense, they can also then hopefully choose treatment. And you can get people out of the cycle. But when they deprioritized that in 2019, that being said, the misdemeanor level, we have to wait for the bill out of the community. And so there's not a lot of things that can happen here except we're at the state level to have that changed. Dr. Rick Reese headed up the addiction department at the UW School of Medicine, and I talk with him frequently to make sure I understand how this works with our state law. Our state law is very conservative, again, in our involuntary treatment compared to other states. Dr. Reese, when he would talk with colleagues in other states, he would talk about the patients would be already voluntarily committed in different states, but our state was not able to do that. So we are leaving people languishing because the system does need to be addressed. And it is something that is significant. You know, the misdemeanor level, people want to avoid a felony, but actually they get a felony charge, so more likely to be able to get restored, again, stabilize them from a mental competency aspect, and hopefully then participate in their, and to make a choice for treatment. But I understand people want system avoidance for felony conviction, but the system is built such that you get more likelihood of getting admitted for restoration of a felony.
I just want to interject a quick, not fact check, because you are both basically right on the number of endorsements. Each of you have 5 endorsements from city council members. Joy Hollingsworth apparently split her endorsement. So just so listeners know, and so the audience here knows as well.
Thank you for the correction and fact check.
It's kind of a follow-up to Sandeep's question. You hear this, I just read an op-ed about it in the New York Times recently, about drug addiction, severe untreated drug addiction. Would you support court-mandated drug treatment programs as an alternative to jail for some people, some number of people who are struggling with severe addiction?
Yeah, and I've spoken with experts in the campaign trail on this. It's a very, very small percentage of folks that, you know, having the right response with experts and service providers that are saying, oh, you know what, I don't want that. And so, yes, reserving the right, you know, to have, you know, that accountability if progress isn't being made is important. But we need to be providing the responses up front and really going to bat on that. And that's the vision I see, because the majority of the time, providing those services with experts like LEAD and CoLEAD works.
These are the bad policies of the past that have gotten us here, where we really do have a population of people who cannot self-care. A dear friend of mine was Tom Hanson, the author of American Junkie, and he would tell me that incarceration saved him. Like having to be in the hospital because he was arrested, but he was so sick from his drug use that he couldn't actually go into jail. That's the only way he got clean. We need to take it seriously. If we think we're being unkind when we're holding people accountable in regards to addiction, we're actually showing we don't care. That we don't really bother spend the time and the effort to help be their own individual guardrails. So I have somebody through the HighWise Initiative, we saw them, they were competent, and then their decade, they're my predecessor, well, my one wants to go back to these times. Competent, incompetent, up and down, over the competency line, on meth for years. And now we only saw him as incompetent. He will not regain competency because that goes through the blood-brain barrier. We did an absolute disservice to him by not saying, we need to get you court-ordered into treatment, but he was sending misdemeanors. So again, as I said earlier, where did we help him?
All right. This next question is about legislative agendas. We'll start with Erica. Your opponent frequently proposed and advocated for legislation, including, we talked about soda laws earlier, but the drug criminalization bill that we've discussed, laws that allow the city to sue graffiti taggers and impose fines on them. But I want to know, what laws will you propose to address those and other issues if you're elected? And are there any laws that the current city attorney has proposed that you will advocate to overturn?
Yeah, I think the big one, we think of our care department and ensuring that they're able to get dispatched without a badge and a gun. That's one huge thing that needs to change for public safety in our city. Having those experts that deal with mental health crises, being able to respond. You know, it's something that, you know, could be fixed in the bargaining with SPOG. It also potentially could be a legislative fix, and having good folks behind you in the legislature, which we have, to get that done is something that we will prioritize, because that's going to save money and taxpayer dollars. With the stuff that's currently in place, I think the biggest thing is the failures on folks getting charged with the drug crimes, and 97% of them not getting treatment. That is what we're going to be doing differently. We're going to make sure those folks are able to get referred into LEAD, so we're not wasting taxpayer dollars by just prosecuting folks and then having them right back out with their addiction again. Thank you for the questions.
And same question for Anne. What's your legislative agenda for a second term if you're reelected? What additional laws are you going to propose?
I will for sure, again, go to get the state toxicology lab ban laws fixed. Over the past decade, as we've had this form of decrim on drugs, as again, my opponent wants to go back where we're not enforcing the standard drug area, and we're talking about letting people just subsist in addiction. Over the past decade, we've had a 96% increase in roadways fatalities due to impaired drivers across our state. That should shock you. I wrote an op-ed in Seattle Times in December 2020. That is the opposite direction with other states. It was the toxicology lab, because it's the only one under state law that can test for blood disorders. That has seen an increase of 50% of cases going to that lab. Those labs are used for 10 years. See, more than half of my UIs are for substances. Polysubstance, not alcohol. So she said earlier, there's different ways of prosecuting. We're doing that. But it is really the backlog at the state toxicology lab. So I will continue to push for a legislative fix where we can open up private labs or any other solution like half the other states do to get that down. 571 days. I can only prosecute DUIs that are happening from 2 years ago. That is not safety for our state. We need to be having that work because that is not a way we can improve our emergency. That's the number one thing.
Really quick response. I'll be quick. The case that I was referring to where we went forward with an effective by prong involved both alcohol and drugs. There's ways that we can be proactive in training officers to, in their reports and in their assessments, providing what they need to prove up the case without having always to have a toxicology report. That is the, you know, an excellent piece in evidence, but it's not always absolutely necessary. And to keep our streets safe and making sure folks are getting held accountable quickly, it takes leaders that have actually been boots on the ground doing this work, and that's what I bring. Thank you.
I've been doing bylaws with officers since 2022, and the most recent one I did was a couple of Fridays ago from 6 p.m. on a Friday to Saturday morning at 3 a.m. to watch them do their work. They backed me. They want me to say the lawyer and prosecutor. They endorse me because they know I'm trying to make sure the public safety system is functioning on behalf of us all.
Thank you. So we've had several audience questions that touch on the on questions of drugs. And so I'm going to take one of them and modify them slightly because I want to try to advance the conversation, because you've both been addressing some of the issues around drugs and addiction. But the question was about the role of reducing open drug use. And I'm going to take this specifically to the question of open air drug markets on our streets, places like Little Saigon or The Blade, you know, Third and Pike and Pine. I forget who started last. We'll start, Erica, with you. If you're elected, specifically related to these sort of big open-air drug markets, you see, I've gone out recently a couple of times with outreach workers to Little Saigon to kind of see them work, do that work. And it's difficult, a difficult situation to experience and to watch. So what would you do specifically about those sort of nodes of persistent large-scale, open-air drug market activity?
Yeah, absolutely. And as the only candidate in this race that's actually prosecuted drug traffickers, I understand the dynamics of that. it's important to have good partnerships with folks at King County that are doing these drug trafficking cases, or assistant United States attorneys doing drug trafficking cases, work I've done. And I'm also honored to have our county prosecutor, Lisa Mannion's endorsement. It comes with making the proper referrals for drug trafficking. For folks that are using, those people need to be in lead. That was what the purpose of the law says, that with this fix of now making it a crime, folks need to be in treatment. And so that is a priority we're going to have. We're not going to have 215 folks being prosecuted for drug use without 97% of them not getting treatment. We're not going to do that, because that's going to continue exactly what you're talking about, Sandeep. The evidence is in the streets of what's not working right now. Thank you.
City Attorney Davidson, same question. We have these persistent open-air drug markets. We all see them in the city of Seattle. We know where they are. Address your thinking about that and how you have been or intend to continue to address that issue.
Absolutely. The Data Drug Area laws were enacted 1 year ago, October 2024. My client has said openly that she will not enforce that law. She told the Seattle Times editorial board. So I think when there's not a solution other than a case managers at lead, I don't really understand what the solution being proposed is. We are looking to disrupt the open-air drug market. Yes, I'm also endorsed by the King County Prosecutor, Lisa Mannion. Okay, so let's move on. What can we do? We are looking to prioritize public spaces. Again, the legislative intent of the underlying drug use and possession mistreatment, as I talked about earlier with you. But we also have to acknowledge there are neighborhoods where people are having to be the frontline workers having to contend with this, as Sandeep described on the sidewalks. So by having things where we can protect neighborhoods and public spaces and foster economic vitality in neighborhoods across our city, as we're having the mayor's clay right now, or having a World Cup next year, we are at the precipice of becoming the Emerald City we should be. And it should not be going back to the ways of the past. The extreme, bad policy of the past that got us to this place, that's not going to help us get out of it. That's just going to take us right back. So we will continue to use the SOTA zones. It was voted in 8-1. Council members asked for them to have zones in their district council location, as well as the stay-out area of prostitution. As the first woman in this position, the stay-out area of prostitution, where predominantly women and girls are trafficked, it leads to violence. The neighborhood that is inundated with that, and they deserve to have our attention.
Really quick response. To be clear, the city attorney has no role in regards to whether or not a soap or soda order gets issued. The judge has the ability to order that. And the other thing is, yes, it would require city council to repeal it. So what I have been saying in this campaign is we're not going to criminally charge someone for being in a banishment zone. It doesn't work. And it's not even currently being done under the current leadership. There's only been two cases that have been criminally charged for violating a SOTA order because it's ineffective. They're failed policies of the past. They were repealed and they were championed by the current leadership. And the last thing I'll say is, yes, a majority of city council knows my stance on this, and a majority of the city council has endorsed my campaign. And when I'm saying a majority, I'm okay. saying for
right.
me.
We're going to yeah. some, we're gonna have to get some audible timers next time.
It probably means that it's improving. Because we don't want people to go back to the open-air drug markets. We're telling them, please don't come back. We want to make it harder for dealers to go up and down the sidewalk to get a fentanyl fix every 15 minutes. That's what we're trying to do. We have charged over 200 soda. We asked for it. She's saying she won't ask the judge for them. And I get the data to the public of what judge is saying yes or no, so you understand for judges. But I ask for them so that we can protect the neighborhoods and try to...
Okay.
The evidence is in the streets, and public safety leaders around our city are united in rejecting that theory that it's working, because it's not. Okay. We can all see it.
I like that you guys are going back and forth. Let's all right, so we got a number of questions that are related to... I think undocumented folks, but people are voting. You know, if you're not on there voting, you should be on there voting on this, what's it called?
Slido
thing. So we're mostly taking audience questions now. We got a bunch. this one, greatest safety threat in Seattle is to the 160,000 foreign-born residents. But I have another one here related to that I'm going to ask that came in earlier. Seattle brands itself a welcoming city, but Ann Davison, what concrete steps will you take to ensure undocumented immigrants and refugees have equitable access to housing, healthcare, and legal support?
Some of those are outside of the scope of my authority, like housing, et cetera. And I will just tell you a little bit about myself in my early adult life. That was the work I wanted to do. So when I talk about what Seattle was like in 2021, it's in crisis. Crisis relief is what I said. I worked in a refugee camp on the border of Cambodia where people were fleeing civil war. And when I did realize that that was more humane and hygienic, and a lot of people that were left along the roadways of Seattle, that was really what made me get involved civically. When it comes to our city, we have a welcoming ordinance, and I have sued the Trump administration for threatening to withhold grants, funds that have been appropriated by Congress because of that ordinance. 4 out of 5 circuits have said that that is lawful. We also have a state law, but that is not mine to defend. Mine is to defend the city ordinance, and so I have done so. We are allowed to have that, so that our funds should not be threatened because of the Trump administration.
Same question.
Yeah. You know, I think back to in this campaign meeting with One America. We had a forum and I was the only person in this race that showed up. And these are folks, our immigrant neighbors that are leading the charge to protect immigrants in our city. And they have solely endorsed this campaign because they know it's important to have leaders that actually care about these issues, that have leaders that have collaborations and partnerships with people like our Attorney General, Nick Brown, to keep Seattle safe, to keep Seattle a sanctuary city. That is a coalition that's behind us, and I'm really excited to move us forward.
Again, I'll just ask, you lived here in 2021. Do you want to go back to the times before that? Even my own teenage kids preemptively tell me that we know this the city is better. Is it all the way better? Absolutely not. But that means we have to continue on the policies that we have put in place to dig out from underneath the 12 years that were there before, where public safety was deprioritized, where accountability was not there. And that is what I bring to the city of Seattle. I'm endorsed by Democratic former Washington governors Christian Gregoire, Gary Locke. They endorsed me in 2021 and again for re-election. I am endorsed by Congressman Anna Smith, and I'm also endorsed by our Seattle firefighters and police officers because they want me to remain a lawyer for the city and the prosecutor.
I believe we deserve to live in a city where we all feel safe and where we can all thrive and where we fight back against federal overreach with courage and with urgency. You know, I think about my family's history in fighting for civil rights. People like my grandfather, a gold medalist in the Olympics, that protested what was happening in our country. That's the same courage that runs through my DNA. I'm honored to have the sole endorsement of MLK Labor. 220 workers in our region are behind us. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, Attorney General Nick Brown, every single Democratic organization in our city is behind us. We have more elected officials than anyone in this campaign, and this campaign is about us. It's not about one person. It's about working together with teams, collaboration, and leadership, and folks with the actual experience to get it done and to be good stewards of public safety and our public dollar.
All right, let's hear it for Erica Evans and City Attorney Ann Davison. Thank you so much. That's it for another edition of Seattle Nice. I'm David Hyde. She's Erica C. Barnett. He's Sandeep Kaushik. Our editor is Quinn Waller. Our producer is Jenny Cecil Moore. And if you want to support local journalism, just go to patreon.com/Seattle Nice. And thanks, everybody, so much for listening, especially this amazing live audience.
Thank you.